Good morning, everybody. And thank you, first of all, for being willing to participate remotely with us this morning at the Court of Appeals. I want to make sure a couple things are clear. Number one, we from time to time have experienced technical glitches or interruptions. We'll understand if that happens on your end. And I would just ask that you be patient with us if it happens on our end. And if there's something that doesn't work correctly, if you can't hear me or somebody freezes, let us know right away so we can address it. In addition to that, if you could please state your name before you begin your argument, and that way we have on our audio recording a clear recording of who is speaking at that time. And then last, if you are in gallery view as opposed to the active speaker view, you should see all of the different cameras that are on at the same time and the same size. And that way you'll also be able to see the clock. All right, let's call the first case.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, Judge Flory, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. Case number A20-0648, Nassif versus Pens.
All right, good morning. And the attorney for appellant?
Thank you, Judge. My name is William French. I represent appellate Michael Nassif. May it please the court, Mr. Ryan. The Minnesota Liens on Personal Property and Self-Service Storage Act was originally passed in 1988, and it was amended in 2014, but we're dealing with the older version, the pre-amended amendment version in 1988, which ties into the enforcement of warehouse lien statute under the Uniform Commercial Code 336.7-210. What the defendants did here to this man and his property is indefensible. They took his property, they gave some away, they threw some away, and probably took some themselves, although they wouldn't admit it at trial. And then 4 years later, they very cynically had an auction where they claim generated $900. That's roughly the amount that the jury awarded in damages in this case. But the problem is the defendants, none of them apparently were even aware of the existence of this statute. They certainly had never looked at it. They ignored it. And what happened in the trial court was the trial court basically adopted the defense view of how this situation should be treated. There, no part of the law was followed. It's not, laws are passed for a reason. The Minnesota legislature passed this law to protect people who stored personal property in self-storage units. But laws are only as good as their enforcement. The statute here as a consumer protection statute, which are largely not favored where I practice, was simply not enforced by the court. What the court did was it grafted onto the statute and expressed in the jury instructions and the special verdict instructions on abandonment and waiver, which eviscerated plaintiff's claim. In effect, the court shifted blame for what happened here to the appellant, Mr. Nassif. I have to mention in passing, there's courts do not exist in a vacuum. They exist in a culture. In this culture, if you don't pay your bills, I think a lot of people think you deserve what you get. And that's sort of the background noise to this case. He deserved what he got because he didn't pay the rental on these storage units. Waiver and abandonment, those instructions and presence on the verdict form were entirely illegal, incorrect, not justified by the law.
So Mr. French, let me ask you to be a little bit more specific when you're talking about the verdict form in this, on this particular aspect of your appeal. There were a lot of questions, including I believe the question that you're referring to. Is it question four? Regarding, it is question four. So are you making any challenge to questions 1 through 3.
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And the trial court shifted the blame for this situation to Mr. Nassif inappropriately and not giving any weight to the statute, which has is very specific. It requires people who own these businesses to give notices. They're supposed to have an auction, and they're supposed to make the person's personal property, the personal items like photographs and tools of the trade for less than $50. They're supposed to make those available to the renter or the person that has signed a lease for a storage unit. That did not occur in this case. All of Mr. Nassif's property was disposed of. And because, and what the lease shows, which were exhibits in the trial and are attached in the addendum, the defendants in this case treated this situation as though they were a landlord. And that is entirely inappropriate. The lease itself is a misleading and deceptive practice. And Mr. Nassif is not the only person this has happened to. In trial testimony, one of the defendants admitted that this is the way they always handle property that where rent has not been paid. So that is a huge problem. The law needs to be enforced. To some extent, it's a self-enforcing law. I mean, there's no provision for the award of attorney fees or anything like that. But nevertheless, the law was not enforced here. The court adopted what the defense posture was. But even something more bizarre happened in this case. I've tried probably between 75 and 100 civil jury trials, and I've never had this experience where a judge comes into the courtroom and simply dismisses sua sponte one of the plaintiff's theories of recovery. The court did that insofar as the consumer fraud statute was concerned, without argument, without even putting it in the record, was simply dismissed. The judge said—
Mr. French, if I could jump in again. On that point, it's my understanding that judges do have, district court judges, as you know, as I was for 6 years, that judges do have the discretion to decide what instructions to give. And if the evidence presented does not merit a specific instruction, it's my understanding judges have discretion not to give an instruction if the evidence doesn't merit such a thing. Are you saying that that's not true? Or are you saying that in this case, the discretion was abused and that the district court lacked or erred in deciding not to give the instruction that you requested regarding this claim?
Well, Your Honor, the irregularity in the proceedings occurred well before the preparation of the jury instructions. I think the trial court has tried to cover her mistake by saying, well, there wasn't enough evidence in the record to submit it to the jury. Your Honor, that claim was simply dismissed by the court during the middle of the trial, well before jury instructions were argued. In fact, I don't think it even, the issue of the consumer fraud statute, because it had been dismissed, wasn't even discussed during jury instructions.
Again, I guess I'm asking a specific question, and perhaps it depends on the sequence, after reviewing the record, it seemed like this the case in chief from the plaintiffs was complete. Is that correct?
No, it was not. She dismissed this. The trial court dismissed a claim, a theory of recovery, sua sponte, from the bench without argument. It'd be like if she's just come in and if the judge had come into the courtroom and said, "I dismissed the case." I assume they're not suggesting that a court can just voluntarily dismiss an entire case.
Well, there are cases where the district court, let's say it's a breach of contract case, for example, and the district court, after hearing the evidence, decides that it doesn't rise to the level of an instruction and can either dismiss, as you're saying, sua sponte through a directed verdict, either before or after the jury returns a verdict. There are also cases where a district court can look at an entire claim and say that the evidence hasn't risen to that, and based on that, decline to give an instruction without formally disposing of or dismissing a claim. So I guess my question for you is, are you saying that those cases are wrong, or are you saying that those cases are correct, but in this case, this judge abused that discretion?
I'm saying in this case, the judge abused her discretion. I recognize that the trial court always has a discretion in submitting jury instructions, but I have to also say that I've never been involved in a case where that has happened. I'm not aware of a decided case where theories of recovery are dismissed without a motion before a case is submitted to the jury. There was no motion made in this case. It was simply dismissed sua sponte.
Mr. French?
Yes.
If I could jump in here with a short question as to prejudice. Let's assume we agree with you on the point that, generally speaking, a judge should not engage this way sua sponte. In order for us to assign error or to offer some remedy to the error, we would have to see some prejudice. Was there an offer of proof made to the district court at that time as to the evidence that you would have submitted had the theory been allowed to continue?
No, there was not. The court just simply dismissed it, and we moved right into proceeding with the trial. The evidence supporting the consumer fraud claim was already in the record. It was the rental agreements, which in and of themselves establish a consumer fraud claim, because they give ownership rights to the owner of the storage facility after 28 days, just as a landlord would have the right in a landlord-tenant situation. The leases themselves establish the consumer fraud. And furthermore, we prove the public interest element of that. The defendants admitted that this form had been used for a long time and been given to hundreds and probably thousands of people. As I've said before, my client wasn't the only person that was victimized by this. There are other people. So on that point, that's why I, in the close of my reply brief, I said, and I asserted, the plaintiff is actually entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the consumer fraud claim, because it's in the record. It's called the leases. There are multiple violations of misleading statement, deceptive practices. When you're running a self-storage storage unit, you can't take ownership of property because they failed to pay the rent. It's that simple. So anyways, and then I wanted to move on to the breach of contract question. That was count one in the complaint. When the trial court reconvened shortly before the case was to be argued and gave the final special verdict form to me, there wasn't a breach of contract question on the verdict form. I objected. The plaintiff was entitled to that instruction. The court said, well, you know, it really assumes that, you know, the rights under the statute, but the contract was something different. Plaintiff was entitled to an instruction on breach of contract, and to not have gotten that instruction is an abuse of discretion. It's an error of law, and it requires reversal and a new trial. And as I said before, just to kind of finish up here, I've just got not much time, but
Mr. French, on the breach of contract question, I was curious to see your proposal, which was pretty broad. It was very simple question. You're right in that regard. I think it said, did defendants breach? Essentially was the question. The question I have for you is, isn't that, if as written, your proposed or question for the verdict form, wouldn't that have allowed for double recovery? Because it's not distinguishing between damages for the breach or damages for the violation of the contract?
That is a good question, Judge, and it's something I thought about. That would get sorted out on the damages question. The plaintiff had two opportunities to recover here. I mean, one could assume that the contract recreated broader rights than the statute, or vice versa. The plaintiff was entitled, or the appellant was entitled, to both questions. He only got one, because if you look closely at the lease agreement, it provides for certain things that are not in the Self-Service Storage Act. So plaintiff was entitled to that instruction, and it's really, and the special verdict form itself was a disaster. I've never seen anything like this. There were headings given, the questions were long and involved. I've learned through experience over 40 years of trying cases that the best thing to do in submitting a special verdict form is to keep the questions as simple as possible. And if you look at the form special verdict questions in the jury instruction guides, all those questions are very simple and straightforward. The more complex you make a question, the greater the chance for error. So my question, and on my proposed verdict form, was just simply dismissed without consideration. And frankly, I have to say, this case was submitted to the jury by people who apparently had no experience with any kind of civil litigation. I believe this is a failure of government. We should have people who are familiar with civil litigation trying cases involving civil litigation.
I don't understand the point you're making.
The point I'm making is oftentimes judges are appointed to the bench and have absolutely zero civil trial experience and then immediately start hearing civil cases. I think that's kind of a third world practice.
I don't understand the remedy that you're asking for that.
Well, I'm just mentioning it, and I'm saying that is what occurred here.
I don't understand how that fits a legal argument. Maybe you can frame that into a legal argument for me.
It fits into a legal argument because of all the errors in the case. If there had been an experienced judge hearing this case, we wouldn't have all these errors in the case. That's my legal argument. We're entitled to a new trial, and the court abused its discretion, and we're also entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the consumer fraud count. Thank you.
Can I ask, when I understand the time has expired, but Judge Brian, may I?
Please.
You caught me by surprise in your final argument there. And are you asking us to remand for a new trial in order that the district court recuse herself because of a lack of sufficient experience in civil law?
Well, I made that claim. Yes, I made that claim in the trial court, but I'm not asking to reverse on that basis. This court, this appellate court, needs to know what's happening in the trial courts. I'm simply reporting to you what's going on. I don't think it's fair to the public. That's my opinion.
Thank you. Mr. Ryan.
I'm having a little trouble figuring out where I want to start on this. I'll start, I guess, by saying, Your Honor, Your Honors, good morning, that the judge here, while she may not have had years and years of experience, didn't do too bad a job, really. She took the time to examine things. Some of the things Mr. French complains about, I think, were actually quite appropriate. For instance, I totally agree with Your Honor that judges have the authority to refuse to instruct on a claim that they haven't seen any evidence to support. And that's exactly what the judge said there.
What about the sequence of presenting evidence and then making the decision that there is insufficient evidence? Do you agree with what Mr. French said, that the district court made that decision prior to the close of the plaintiff's case in chief?
Well, I'm not quite sure that I agree specifically with Mr. French's remarks there. It seems to me that there had been an awful lot of the case in chief involved, and a lot of it washed into that particular issue that chief examined and said, I don't see any evidence of it. I don't think Mr. French had rested yet at that point, but he certainly didn't do much to disabuse her of her ideas there. So I don't know that that's necessarily a close call, but it's a little closer than perhaps is something I'm comfortable with. Nonetheless, she was pretty completely straightforward on it.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your last point. You're not comfortable with what?
I guess what I'm not comfortable with is the approach that Mr. French takes to this. The judge has listened to a lot of evidence. He didn't seem to object, as I recall the record here. He didn't object on any specified ground to her decision to not instruct on that fraud claim. Looking at the record that I saw, there wasn't a heck of a lot there that would support a fraud claim. And I think that's the issue that Mr. French doesn't like, is that it was pretty weak on the consumer fraud. So her dismissal of that, if you want to call it that, she simply said she refused to instruct on it. I would imagine that she could have changed her mind if Mr. French had come back at some other time in the trial and presented more evidence or a better argument, but that was not done.
Is there any decision or order from the court formally disposing of that claim?
Not that I can recall right off the top of my head, Judge. I think she said, I'm not going to instruct on it, and that's in the record. I don't think there was a formal dismissal of it. She simply said, I will not instruct because there is no evidence to support an instruction. Shall I move on? Okay. The other thing that that comes up in this case is this idea that somehow these gentlemen abused everything and simply stole property from Mr. Nassif. Nothing could be further from the truth. Mr. Nassif came in, he signed a contract, and he almost immediately went into default on the contract. He made, I think, two payments, or maybe only one monthly payment, and then never made another payment. Never a payment, even through all of the litigation that went on, never an offer to try and cure, simply taking the position that somehow the contract didn't make any sense, or it was not something that could be enforced. I think he was completely wrong on that. He signed a contract. He agreed to pay a rental fee or a storage fee, if you want to call it that, paid one payment and quit. What is the landlord supposed to do? What is the property owner supposed to do? Continued calling him and trying to reach him, which is what they did do. With no success, and that's in the record fairly clearly, no success at all.
You never Mr. Ryan, let me, yeah. If I could ask you a question here. It sounds to me that you're really arguing prejudice. Do you agree that the contract that was signed here did not comply with the requirements of the Self-Storage Act?
No, I don't agree with that, Judge.
Okay, how did it comply? Mr. French has identified areas where it didn't comply in terms of, I think, the period of notice and, you know, the opportunity to cure the default. You're taking the position that the contract that was signed in this matter is in complete compliance with the Self-Storage Act?
Well, Judge, that's an interesting question to ask in this case, because the way I read what was done here, the Self-Storage Act was brought into it, but the parties at the trial said that they were going to, they applied the pre-amendment version of that act and included the Warehouse Lien Act, which was the prior iteration of the Self-Storage Act. So the Self-Storage Act of 2014 did not apply by agreement of the parties. The Self-Storage Act that did apply was the 2013 version, which included the, I'm losing my train of thought here. The two, well, which included the things that Mr. French complains about primarily, and takes away the, let's put it this way, takes away the argument, I guess, that somehow the forfeiture of the property was improper, because that warehouse storage lien act is completely different than the 2014 revision, which sort of put a hold on taking property. So I think that the act and the contract we're dealing with was the 2013 version, which is different. And I think that was complied with. Now I've lost my train of thought. What was my next issue? Well, we've talked about the refusal to instruct. We've talked about the Self-Storage Act lien. The other thing that I wanted to speak about and that generated this appeal to start with was the idea that Mr. French has that that it's impossible, I guess, for people to comply. I'm trying to remember what I was going to say about that. Okay. Mr. French takes the position that the respondents took possession of the property, treated it as their own, and in effect owned the property by their actions following the forfeiture of it to them. The testimony in the case was different than that. The testimony was that they waited, they called him, they tried to get him to come and arrange things, take his property back. They testified under oath in court in the case in chief here that he could have picked it up at any time up until the time it was finally sold and disposed of. That was sometime after their default or the plaintiff's default. So, in fact, one of the questions was, you could have picked up the property the day before. Yes, that was their answer. Yes, they would have given him his property. He simply had to comply with the statute, and I'm sorry, with his contract. Had he come in and just said, give me all my property, I kind of doubt that they would have said, okay. I mean, that would be a breach of their contract by themselves. Why would they do that? So I'm a little bit at a loss as to how this is something as earth-shattering as Mr. French is making it out to be. The gentleman that entered into this contract knew what he signed it, agreed to make payments to keep his property there, paid one payment, quit paying, did nothing for quite some period of time. And then suddenly, 5 years afterwards, we're in court. I don't think that this case implies any huge societal change, like Mr. French seems to argue. This is just a real straightforward, small claim. Had Mr. Nassif paid his payments when he was supposed to, we wouldn't be here. He did not pay and has never paid, except for that very first payment, as I recall. For those reasons, I think the decisions down in the district court were correct and should be upheld. Thank you.
Mr. Ryan, the verdict form includes an award of $1,357.80, and you did not cross appeal, so you're not arguing that that is error for the judgment to include that amount. Is that right?
The jury found that, and the judge incorporated it, and we're not challenging that.
And what do you think that is related to? Which claim is that related to?
I don't know. I assume that it's related to the disposal of the property, but I don't know. And there's not any record that I am aware of that would tell us that.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't see other questions from the other members of the panel this morning. Mr. French, as soon as that clock shows up, there we go. You may proceed with your rebuttal.
As I stated previously, what they did here to this person was indefensible. He's not the only person who's been treated this way. This statute needs to be enforced. And if it wasn't enforced in the trial court, this court needs to make clear in its decision that this statute will be enforced in the future. There appears to be only one case in Minnesota involving this statute. That's the Johans case. And that really dealt with an exculpatory clause in the context of a self-service storage relationship. So this may be the first case that's ever really been before the appellate court on whether the trial courts need to enforce the provisions of this statute. As I said before, laws are great, but if they're not enforced, I mean, what's the point?
So on questions 1, 2, and 3 of the verdict form, it looks to me like what the jury was asked whether there was a violation, and then whether that violation was willful. And so as I read that verdict form, it seems that the jury was instructed regarding the law that you're saying was not enforced here, and that they rendered a verdict that is adverse to your position that you disagree with, but you're not appealing those answers. So it's not as if the law wasn't enforced. If you look at the questions, it was, did defendants violate the self-storage lien law? Did defendants complete the requirements of the warehouse lien law? Did defendants willfully violate the? So they answered those questions. They just answered them in defendant's favor, at least the third one.
Well, Your Honor, I have to point out that the crux of the defense at trial was abandonment and waiver. And if that infuses the case, when the jury's presented with a question about whether disposing of the property was willful or not, they're likely to say no. It's the whole instructions must be looked at in total. You can't pick them out individually, and you can't look at the verdict form just individually. Question 3, while it says it wasn't a willful violation, I think that was conditioned by the jury's instructions on abandonment and waiver. As I pointed out in my initial brief, the waiver instruction.
But Mr. French, in all your 40 years of trial experience, certainly you've come across cases where attorneys have alternative theories. And if a jury buys the first one, then there's no need to address the second one, or it affects the way the second one is, the importance of the second one. And it seems to me in this case, by answering question 3 the way that they did, that's separate from waiver, right? Question 3 is, did defendants willfully violate? No. And question 4 is, did the plaintiff waive his claims?
And that's
and it seems to me that if it doesn't matter whether plaintiff waived his claims if the jury found that the defendants did not violate the law. Well, it doesn't matter if the plaintiff also waived that, right? Well, it's just an alternative, and it doesn't infuse the jury's decision as because parties, as you know, make alternative theories in trial all the time.
I know, but still, that is only a part of the statute. Questions 1 and 2 establish the plaintiff's the liability on the defendants. The willful thing only relates to conversion by the terms of the statute. I also point out, I didn't point it out in my brief, that the waiver of this statute is prohibited by 514.978. A person who rents a self-storage facility can't.
I'm sorry, Mr. French, I'm going to ask you to repeat yourself because we lost your audio there for a second. And I'll also ask the marshal to stop the clock. I feel like it's a sporting event. Can you please put an additional 20 seconds back on the clock? Are you able to hear us okay, Mr. French?
Yes, I am. And frankly, I think I might have. I didn't move off mute. And maybe you haven't been hearing my all anything.
No, we heard all that you had said up until like the last sentence or two.
Well, the willful only relates to whether there was a conversion or not. It doesn't relate to whether there was a violation of the statute, which is established in questions one and two. But by allowing abandonment and waiver, it puts all the blame on plaintiff that it's his fault that he didn't go back and get this stuff. Mr. Ryan doesn't talk about he would have had to pay for the rental charges, which were stipulated to, and that's the counterclaim. I stipulated to the amount that they would be entitled for the past due storage fees. They can't avoid liability in this case simply because the jury concluded it wasn't willful. The court has to look at the entire case. Waiver should have not have been in this case. The plaintiff should have been allowed to submit to the jury the question of consumer fraud. It was simply dismissed in the middle of the case. It wasn't even discussed in jury instructions. That whole argument by the trial court is just a make-weight argument. At least my experience, judges don't come into the courtroom to simply willy-nilly dismiss major claims of a party without more. My time is up, but thank you.
All right, thank you both. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Judge.